Welcome to Community Conversations, a monthly program on KUMD dedicated to topics of interest in our community and fostering our community connections. I'm your host, Lisa Johnson, and this evening we'll be talking about the infrastructure in the city of Duluth. It's well known that the city was facing challenges with the infrastructure on a variety of fronts before the catastrophic flood of June 2012, and the storm damage only exacerbated those problems. In this half hour, we'll take a look at the history and challenges of building in this city on a hill, the systems that were already becoming critical before the floods, where we are now, and where we go from here.
I'm Jim Benning, Public Works Utilities Director for the City of Duluth.
Marianne Bourne, Executive Director with the Western Lakes Pier Sanitary District.
And Don Ness, Mayor of the City of Duluth.
Jim, let's start with you. Let's talk about how Duluth's infrastructure developed initially, way back in the boom days of the late 1870s. My understanding was that there was, comparatively speaking, a lot of money to be spent, and folks were pretty committed to making this a pretty up-to-date kind of place to live.
At the time when the utilities were installed, they were up to date at that time of that current technology. Initially, the water system in Duluth was actually a private, held privately, and I didn't realize that until just recently. And in 1897 is when the city bought the water utility from this private organization for $1.25 million. And the reason they did that at that time, because there was outbreaks of typhoid. And in 1895, there were 1,500 cases and 100 deaths that year. And that's what prompted the city to take over ownership of the water plant.
Do you know what they did then to quell the spread of typhoid? Was the water not being treated?
It certainly wasn't being treated well enough. And I think a lot of it was the conveyance system and the method of conveyance, what it was put in when it was brought to the private homes. In 1896 or 1897, that's when the liquid water treatment plant, the castle-looking structure on Congan Boulevard, was constructed. And the number of disease-related illnesses tapered off greatly from that point on.
Tell us a little bit about the challenges of Duluth's infrastructure, just because of our physical location. As the city has been developed, what are some of the things that people have had to contend with in terms of putting in water, putting in roads?
Obviously, the physical shape of Duluth has a big influence on the city. It's 26 miles long, and it's, you know, a couple miles wide at its largest point. Another physical aspect is the elevation change. There's 883 feet of elevation change, and you can imagine the water has to be pumped from lake elevation, in some cases up to 800 feet. The physical challenges of getting that water all the way from liquid pump station to Fond du Lac neighborhood.
What about the rock? I thought I'd understood, too, that just the fact that the city is sitting on rock makes it a challenge.
We've got rock and we've got clay, and there's not a lot of in between. The rock, obviously, if we're building utilities under there, we have to blast our way through that rock, and the clay soils are also a problem in the wintertime. They heave a lot, which causes pipes to crack from the frost movement, and also these soils are corrosive to our metal pipes, which causes a lot of corrosion and water breaks, water leaks.
What prevented updates to things like the sewer system, the water system, the street system in some areas, street repair, in a kind of an organized, comprehensive way in the 50s or the 60s or the 70s or even the 80s?
I think it's a combination of our history as a city, as well as political realities. You know, the infrastructure was put in place in most cases in the early 1900s, and it was in decent shape for the first half of that century. And even as we get into the 50s and 60s, it was still functioning well. And the last thing that people want to spend limited tax dollars on are infrastructure that they don't see and they don't think about until they turn on their tap and nothing comes out. Or if we have overflows into Lake Superior, it's only the failure of the infrastructure that people think about it. Fast forward into the 70s and 80s and early 90s, and those were difficult times in the city of Duluth. We didn't see the growth. We were trying to maintain our population, trying to maintain you know, the vibrancy or even the stability of our city. And so it becomes very difficult when you're facing these massive challenges to say, we're going to spend millions of dollars investing in our underground infrastructure, again, that people don't think about. And so now here we are today facing a system that hasn't been invested in, hasn't been renewed in any substantial way for since it was first built in the early 1900s. And we're seeing a number of problems in the form of sanitary sewer overflows or water main breaks or just the increasingly unreliability of this infrastructure. And we're now faced with the prospect of having to play catch-up, and it's very expensive. Obviously, in retrospect, looking back, yeah, it would have been great if starting 50, 60 years ago, if we would have made incremental improvements to modernize this system as we were doing road construction, but that didn't happen. So we are where we are, and now we have to make the most of it.
Let me ask you, Don, from your perspective, working obviously within the political structure as you have for this length of time, was it a responsible decision to basically kick the can down the road? Or should somebody have said, you know, it's not sexy, but we got to redo the sewer system?
You know, there's always the other side. And, you know, the politicians at that time said, you know, it's important to our taxpayers and ratepayers in the city of Duluth that we keep rates low. Now, I think in retrospect, yeah, with foresight in mind or thinking about the long-term health of our system, we probably should have made those investments. But even today as we struggle with the effects of a lack of investment over many decades, it's still very difficult to encourage the city council, encourage the public to support additional investment in our infrastructure because it is an investment that has returns over the next 50 years. The impact or the effect of making a large investment today, the benefits are incremental as well. So we don't see that immediate, wow, things are so much better now that we've spent $5 million fixing a reservoir. In some ways, it's only not going to be catastrophically worse because we didn't invest that $5 million in a reservoir.
Marianne, tell us a little bit now about when and why and in response to what WLSSD was created, because that does seem like a pretty forward-thinking decision on the part of the city and the citizens of this area.
The idea behind the Western Lakes Pier Sanitary District probably took 30 to 40 years to ruminate and to reach public acceptance. And the thing that really started it, you know, Jim had mentioned typhoid deaths due to contaminated water. There continued to be recordable deaths due to typhoid into the 1940s. And the thing that really started to strike the need for looking at a better regional wastewater treatment solution really came from recreational fishermen who were noticing that with all of the industry in the city of Duluth and the city of Cloquet, that the St. Louis River was becoming more and more polluted. And if you look at some of the Duluth News Tribune articles back as early as the 1950s and the 1960s, there are numerous fish kills. And it's quite interesting to look at. In the 1960s, people were still saying, we don't know why this is occurring. It didn't take too long for people to figure out. It was because the dissolved oxygen levels in the St. Louis River were dropping to the point of being very close to zero. And at that point, aquatic life no longer can thrive and live. Back in about the mid-1960s, the discussion started on something needs to happen. What's the best solution? Should the city of Cloquet build their own wastewater treatment plant? Should the city of Duluth look at building theirs? And it was a very unique number of circumstances that happened all at the same time. Industry, particularly the large paper mill in Cloquet, Minnesota at that time, which was Potlatch Paper Company, was being told by the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency that they could no longer discharge into the St. Louis River. And so they needed to look at a solution. City of Cloquet also needed water, and they were looking at what would be the possibility of being able to extract water from Lake Superior because the St. Louis River was so polluted and the flow was so low, it was difficult to supply water to the city of Cloquet. City of Duluth was having those same challenges. They needed to do something from a wastewater treatment standpoint. In 1972, the federal government passed the Clean Water Act. And one of the most important parts of the Clean Water Act was not only did it dictate what people needed to do for pollution prevention and treatment, but it also allowed for grant money. And so in the early 1970s, there was 75% funding available from the federal government to build the Western Lakes Pier Sanitary District. And that funding then was matched by 15% dollar match from the state of Minnesota. So locally, whether it was the city, whether it was local industries, they had to put up very little cash to build this. And so the decision was made, one regional treatment facility, it cost about $100 million to build in its onset. And, you know, we continue to see the benefits of having one treatment plant that we all discharge to.
You're listening to Community Conversations here on KUMD. Our guests this evening are Duluth Mayor Don Ness, Jim Benning, the Director of Public Works and Utilities for the City of Duluth, and Marianne Boren, the Executive Director of the Western Lake Superior Sanitary District. Jim, as we fast forward to the future, what situations were becoming critical before the flooding in June? We've talked a lot about an infrastructure that, for a variety of reasons, was not updated as we went along. But I understand that we had actually gotten to some areas that really were pretty critical before the June flood.
The sanitary sewer system in the city of Duluth was reaching a critical point about 10 years ago when we were having excessive overflows into Lake Superior. And the federal government stepped in the recent years and mandated that we eliminate sanitary sewer overflows into Lake Superior, and we became under a consent decree, which essentially says by a specific date, in our case was 2016, you need to eliminate those. And we've been taking great strides in doing that, lining our public system, mandating sump pumps and ladder lines and other programs that the utility department has undertaken. And I'm happy to report that if it weren't for the flood in 2012, we would have had zero overflows in that particular year. And we were not penalized because we had that flood. We were under a force majeure, which essentially says an act of God, which did occur, we would not be penalized. So we've made great strides. I had a utility operations manager that used to say if a cloud went over a lakeside, not even rain, we would have an overflow. And now we can have great rainfall without any overflows at all. So we've had great success there.
What situations became even more serious after the flood?
For the Western Lake Superior Sanitary District, of course, compromised pump stations, we had pipe breaks, we had a lot of things that needed to be fixed and need to be fixed immediately to make sure that wastewater continued to flow to the wastewater treatment plant. Unfortunately, you know, as Jim mentioned, with the consent decree, City of Duluth has had a number of projects underway, as has the Western Lake Superior Sanitary District. And unfortunately, one of the projects that we had just completed not more than a month before the flood, a new section of line put in, the flood severely compromised a slope that pipe was in. And so, you know, unfortunately, we had to back up and redo some projects that at least on June 15th had been complete. So it did, I think, for us, and I think also for the City of Duluth, it did kind of stop the progress that we were making moving forward on correcting sewer overflows and made us step back and correct some of these things that just were unique to the flood.
There's three water-related utility systems for the City of Duluth, and especially as it relates to the flood, I think there is some confusion in the community about what was the impact to those three different systems. Obviously, the water system is one that people interact with the most and they think about, and the water system actually wasn't affected by the flash flood. The second is the sanitary system, and as Marianne was talking about, there was some impacts to that. We did have overflows because there was so much water entering our system, it simply overwhelmed the capacity of that system. But for the City of Duluth, the system that took the most damage and was, I think, most in line for capacity issues was our stormwater system. And the stormwater system takes a lot of different forms, and it's unique in the sense that it is a utility system. It plays a critical role, and as water falls, how are we going to manage that as it comes down our hillside? And it can take the form of ditches and culverts. It can take the form of bridges and in our streams. And we have, you know, 30, 40 streams that are coming down our hillside. Those are critical pieces of our stormwater infrastructure. They act as giant funnels for the rainwater that falls in our neighborhoods, and then they enter the streams. And it was at that point where the culverts were simply too small to handle the volume and the velocity of the rainwater that was entering into those systems. And there's a couple of reasons for that. One is that those systems, those stormwater systems, were put in place when we didn't have this type of severe event as often as we've seen now recently. And those systems were put in place before the development on top of the hill. And it's the development on top of the hill, which were kind of swampy marshlands and would absorb a lot of the rainwater that would fall and would hold it on top of the hill. Now we have so much impervious surface up there that it enters into the Miller Creek, and then that volume and velocity of the water entering into the systems on top of the hill only gain more volume and more velocity as it comes down the hill and overwhelms the systems, blows out culverts, blows out bridges, blows out sides of roads, and that's where we saw the damage.
There was also a lot of street damage, Jim. We haven't talked a lot about streets as infrastructure, but tell us a little bit about how the streets and the roads took a beating.
Yeah, the streets and roads certainly took a beating, and there wasn't any neighborhood that got through this unscathed. And the age of the roads really didn't play that much of an effect either. There were new roads that completely fell apart, and there were new roads that held together well, and we had some old roads that completely fell apart, and vice versa. So it's hard to say that it was the age of the roads. But moving forward, we're going to be looking at the streets and utilities as one comprehensive plan. You can't really do one without the other. One of our largest complaints is we just rebuilt the street, and the next year there's a water main break underneath it, and we get calls on that. And it's very difficult to do the utilities without, you know, replacing the entire road. We've gotten complaints that there's just this patchwork quilt. So it definitely needs to be looked at in a holistic approach. And that's what our plan is moving into the future.
I think many people had reaction that we had this big crisis and we had chunks of road washed out and we had these things that we need to repair. They needed to be repaired before the flood. Is there maybe going to be some money available now because of the flood that will help us to get some of these things done, not only to make reparation for flood damage, but that will maybe help us make some of these updates and upgrades that we've needed to make for a while now?
A little bit, but not much. You know, most of the monies that are available from FEMA and from the state are pretty much to repair the damage that was done. And even with that support from the feds and the state, we're going to struggle to get back to where we were on June 18th of last year. And we're going to expend a tremendous amount of resource and time and energy to try to get back to that very place. So the way that those monies are, and especially the nature of the damage that we experienced, is pretty narrow. You know, it didn't damage a mile long of street. You know, it damaged one segment of street completely. And that one segment of street needs to be completely reconstructed. But the road on either side of that segment is going to continue to be in the same condition that it's been.
What about from your perspective, Jim, in terms of, okay, we've got to make these repairs anyway. How can we get the most out of these repairs? How can we do the most good as long as we've got to be in there grubbing around anyway?
The city council passed a resolution about 2 years ago creating the Public Utilities Commission. And this commission was tasked with coming up with long-term plans and funding strategies to tackle those issues that you talked about. You know, we've obviously got a problem with our water system, and they've passed a resolution for the capital plan for the next 10 years, how our money's going to be spent in a strategic and systematic approach. And we're going to be doing the same thing with the gas system and the sanitary system and our storm sewer system. So it's thought out not only what we're going to do, but what it's going to take to pay for these and the funding strategies moving forward to take care of that. The plan that's been talked about so far was the water plan, and the water system itself remained fairly intact. I think we had one water main break during the flood, so there wasn't a lot of issues. So we're just moving on as planned with our water system. The utility that took the biggest beating, obviously, was our storm sewer system, and the majority of those repairs are going to be funded through FEMA and through the state and other governmental agencies. So we're tracking along as planned with the Public Utilities Commission.
You're listening to Community Conversations here on KUMD. Our guests this evening are Duluth Mayor Don Ness, Jim Benning, the Director of Public Works and Utilities for the City of Duluth, and Marianne Boren, the Executive Director of the Western Lake Superior Sanitary District. As we talk about moving forward, where do we go from here in terms of repairs? Where do we go from here in terms of changing things that already exist? Where do we go from here in terms of the way we will approach perhaps new construction?
Well, there's, again, the three utilities, stormwater, sanitary, and our water system. And each of those three have one major issue that is almost at a crisis point or has been at a crisis point. For the water system, it's the water main breaks. And we saw it up in Piedmont, and we saw it down on Superior Street. When you have a water main break, because this infrastructure is so old, it shuts down the water service. It's extraordinarily expensive for city staff to go dig up the roads just to fix that break and then fill in the street on top of it. So water main breaks is one crisis, and we need to get ahead of that. The second is the sanitary sewer overflows into Lake Superior and into the St. Louis River. And this is a tremendous success story for our community over the past 5 years. In partnership with the WLSSD and the city, you know, we were being sued by the federal government over this issue. We had untreated sewage entering into the greatest of the Great Lakes. And because we took very aggressive action and because we had partners at the state and federal level to help us with the funding, we have now pretty much solved that problem. You know, we're going to have to stay vigilant and continue to make those investments, but we have solved it. And I think that's proof that when we can focus our energies and our efforts as a community on these huge, massive problems, we can succeed. And then on the stormwater system, we do have, especially as storms get worse and we have more development on top of the hill, we're going to see increased pressure on our stormwater system and that rainwater rushing down the hill and potentially overwhelming the system as we saw in the flood. And that's where the rain gardens, that's where managing stormwater at the site before it gets into the system is so critical. So, for example, in the city of Duluth, if there is new development up by the mall, they need to have on-site stormwater management systems in which they maybe hold that water for a time so that then as the storm passes, then they release the water into the system so it doesn't overwhelm it. And we're looking at strategies that can be done through the zoning code. There are strategies that we encourage homeowners and businesses to take on themselves to manage stormwater on site. And then community projects like water gardens also help and contribute to the management of that water system, which is even more important because we are a city built on a hill. And it's not only the volume and the potential damage that could occur, but it's also the sediments that get into that water that after it goes through our stormwater system, enters into the St. Louis River, enters into Lake Superior and affects our water quality.
Marianne, you talk a little bit about where we go from here and how we either change what's in existence or plan differently for the future.
I think one of the things that was a learning or an observation on our part from the flood was a few years back, we did sit down and we took a very detailed, meticulous evaluation of our infrastructure, both the sewer lines, the plant itself, our pumping capacity, and put together a criticality matrix to determine how do you balance the amount of money and the ability to hold rates and control with all of these capital projects that you need to do. And in that prioritization, we put a very detailed plan together. And we've been following that plan very religiously. And that is also making that determination that even though people would love rates to go down, that's unrealistic when you look at the amount of capital that needs to be spent. But if you become comfortable with the idea that there never will be a year where there's so much money, you can do all of this catch up with capital, and you can back up and say, that means we have to do those projects that are necessary each and every year, even if that means rates have to increase by 1% or 2%. To the extent we can keep them at zero, we will absolutely try to do that. But once we became comfortable with that idea, we've spent between $8 to $10 million in capital on the sewer system each and every year. And I think one of the things that we found out during this flood is, you know what, we spent the money in the right places. Those areas where we had issues were not issues because we didn't spend capital from a sewer standpoint. As Don said, some of it's stormwater, but we're a regional system. So part of where we had probably the most extensive damage was in the Jay Cook Thompson Township area. And while stormwater played into that, they have far less impervious surfaces. It was the problem with the forebay on the dam, just things that are very difficult to anticipate and take planning on the part of a lot of utilities. So I think one of the things that we learned is we need to continue with that idea that you have to spend capital in the right places and you have to spend some every year, just like your house. You can't let it fall apart. You've got to continue to invest a little bit every year to keep it in good working order. And if we continue to do that, I don't know that it's realistic to design a system that could handle a 500-year flood and still work the way it's supposed to day in and day out. But I do think, you know, if we look at what happened over the Memorial Day weekend last year before the flood, we had 3 days of extremely heavy rain. It did not let up once. And from a stormwater standpoint, from a sewer standpoint, the system worked perfectly. We had no overflows. Unfortunately, the June storm, I was out in the middle of the night, and I can tell you that rain was coming down in sheets. I don't know that there's anything that we can necessarily change in our planning as a sewer district to be able to address that any more effectively than we did during the flood.
Jim, where do we go from here moving forward? Do we make changes to things that are existing? I mean, I realize now that a chunk of the mall and the Walmart parking lot and stuff, that's Hermantown. So that's out of the jurisdiction, or is that a whole different discussion?
It may be out of the jurisdiction, but I don't think water or the creeks necessarily care where the boundaries are between Hermantown and the city of Duluth. So we've got to work together with the other communities, and public education is a real important key for this whole thing. Nobody wants to pay more for any of their utilities, but I think if they have an understanding of what's at stake and the age of the existing infrastructure and what could happen in the future if we don't repair that, they're going to be more accepting of that. Not necessarily like it, but at least they have an understanding of why we have to do this.
There is going to be a cost in operating and maintaining these systems. The water main break problem is a good example of, it's not a question of whether or not we're going to spend money to operate and maintain these systems. It's how we're going to spend that money. We can either try to be proactive and make critical investments in that infrastructure and replace lines when we have the opportunity, or we're going to spend millions of dollars every year paying overtime for crews to come out in the middle of a January evening at 20 degrees below to dig up Superior Street and fix a water main break, and then put the dirt back on, and nothing has been solved. We're still spending money. We're spending it really inefficiently, but we're still expending money. So why not be smart about this and get ahead of these problems like we have on the sanitary sewer issue, and do the same with the water system and do the same with our stormwater system so that we can avoid the next blowout of a culvert and spend millions of dollars fixing that problem when we could have done it with a preventative measure. It does take leadership from the city council, from the Public Utilities Commission, and from the public to say, yes, we understand and support, you know, a modest increase in our rates in order to make the capital investments in a proactive way so that we can avoid the future cost of the catastrophe that is so expensive to react to.
So is the idea of doing the street repairs and the water main repairs at the same time, is that part of that proactive plan?
Absolutely. And that has been a policy now that we've been working to implement over the past couple of years. And because of the casino funding issue, we haven't been able to do as much street reconstruction as we need to. But as we get that new street funding program in place, we have an absolute commitment to make sure that we are replacing the water and sewer infrastructure under these roads. And that's an incremental step that we need to stay committed to really for the next 3 or 4 decades as these streets get reconstructed. But there's also a need to get under the streets that aren't going to be reconstructed and start lining these water lines and sewer lines so that the integrity of those lines can be improved, even if we're not going to reconstruct a street.
Community Conversations on KUMD is a monthly program dedicated to topics of interest in our community and fostering our community connections. I'm your host, Lisa Johnson. Thanks to our guests, Don Ness, Jim Benning, and Marianne Boren. Community Conversations is produced by Chris Harwood and Lisa Johnson and funded by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund.